Hey, what's up, guys? Travis here. And if you've been following me or my story for any length of time, you know that I started a company called Guestio about a year and a half ago now. And one of the things that we are doing this year in 2022 is we're building a concierge program called the Fast Pass that allows you to get booked on top quality shows and platforms for the purpose of spreading awareness for your brand, grabbing attention, growing your credibility, your authority, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you are listening to this right now and you are a seven-figure plus entrepreneur and you have a budget to bring in traffic, attention, credibility, authority to your brand, then this might be a really great program for you. Just head over to travischappell.com/10K. Why 10K? Because we guarantee in this program that you're going to be able to speak in front of 10,000 people within 90 days. Okay, 10,000 people within 90 days. Imagine getting on a stage in front of 10,000 people to share your message, your story. Well, that's exactly what we are doing inside of this program through virtual stages like podcasts or virtual events or YouTube channels or blogs. You name it, we are working with it and we are trying to get you booked on those platforms. So travischappell.com/10x. There's a quick application there. And then right at the end of that application, it'll prompt you to set up a phone call where you'll jump on a call with me and we'll talk through whether or not you're a great fit for this program. Please act fast on this. Do not wait because we are only taking on one or two clients a week due to constraints with our team and the limited supply of high quality shows and platforms that are out there in the market. So if that's you and you're really wanting to explode your brand in 2022, head over to travischappell.com/10K, fill out the application, schedule a quick phone call, and you and I will chat really soon about whether or not this would be a great fit for you. Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
Hey, this is Donald Miller, author of Building a Story Brand. And if you want to level up your relationships, you should be listening to the Build Your Network podcast with my good friend, Travis Chappell.
If you're tired of the old way of networking, the business cards, the awkward conversations, and the aggressive pitches, but you know how crucial your network is to your success in life, then you're in the right place. Welcome to Build Your Network, the only top-rated show committed to helping you master content networking, foster real relationships, increase your authority, and build the network of your dreams. Listen in on conversations with world-class entrepreneurs, authors, thought leaders, and more as we deconstruct their best strategies for your success. So get ready to burn your business cards, ditch the name tag, and discover the new way to network with your host, Travis Chappell.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Build Your Network. Today, I am sitting down with an absolute legend, Don Miller. Don is the CEO of Business Made Simple, an online platform that teaches business professionals everything they need to know to grow a business. He's the host of the Business Made Simple podcast and is the author of several books, including the number one Wall Street Journal bestseller, Building a Story Brand. He lives and works in Nashville, Tennessee with his wife, Elizabeth. Guys, it's going to be such a fun conversation that I have with Don all about marketing and branding and everything in between. But before we get into that conversation, really quickly, if you are a podcast host or a content host, or you like to be a guest on podcasts or on other pieces of content, then you're going to want to head over to guestio.com. That's guestio.com. It's a software that my team and I put together recently. We're still in the startup phase that helps connect high-level podcast hosts and content hosts with high-level guests for their shows. So if you are one of those two types of users, then be sure to head over to guestio.com, set up your free profile, and start browsing through some of the amazing guests and shows that we have built up over there. That's guestio.com. Don, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show. I'm super excited to chat with you for a little bit.
I'm grateful to be here, Travis. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. Of course. So I want to take it all the way back here just to build some context for those listening. We always find that it's helpful to kind of start at the beginning because it gives us a little bit better context for what has come out of your life's work now as you see it. So let's rewind the clock, maybe 11-year-old Donald Miller, you know, set the scene for us. Where'd you grow up? What were your parents doing? And how'd you like school? All that good stuff.
11-year-old Don is not the same. I think we could all look back and see the transformation that has taken place in our lives. But, you know, we grew up hard. I won't lie. We grew up in south of Houston, Texas, and my mom never made a living wage. And dad split when I was two. And so all that, you know, leads to a lot of craziness. And so I grew up really just trying to survive, and the family was just trying to survive at all times. That said, I had a delightful childhood. My mom did such an amazing job raising my sister and I. She passed. She's my hero. But 11-year-old Don is, there's not parents early on around. Mom wouldn't get home till 6 or 7 o'clock. And, you know, we would just sort of raise ourselves. And my sister and I weren't super close. So 11-year-old Don was an introvert, used to play, you know, basketball in the driveway. It was what I would do, and ride my bike around. And those were lonely years, but I'm so grateful for them, because now, you know, I can sit alone in a cabin for a month and finish a book. Mm. And there's not a lot of people who can do that. Not that I do that very often, because my wife won't let me, but but I'm capable of that. And so, you know, a lot of the hardship that we had, but not only that, but, you know, I read an article once, Travis, that said, you know, what are the differences between really successful CEOs and sort of great CEOs, you know, great to really great? One of the main common denominators of those who make that next leap, that highest leap, is they grew up poor. I really never would have imagined that. But there's this kind of scarcity mindset of where we're going to get our next meal that stays with you even after you succeed. And that hunger, that literal hunger, turns into a sort of hunger for success or hunger for security. And so the point is, a lot of the stuff we struggled with when we were kids has turned around and blessed us. And I feel that way very much so.
How did that play into your decision making for post high school in your career? Like, when you were in high school, did you have any idea you'd end up be doing, you know, the things that you're doing now?
No, no clue. I didn't go to college. We really never talked about college in my home because it was
So you're saying that you did not go to college?
No.
But you have a successful career.
I have a successful career, and my curriculum is taught at universities like Vanderbilt University. So I'm not, okay. I mean, you tell me how that happened.
Just making sure that there wasn't
Travis,
faulty wiring here.
Yeah. Here's a funny story. There's a guy on my staff who's a good friend. His name is Dr. JJ Peterson. JJ did his doctoral thesis on Story Brand Framework, which is the framework that I created. Mm. And then Vanderbilt University called JJ and said, hey, can you come in and explain this to us? Well, then they asked JJ to be an adjunct professor teaching the Story Brand Framework. And literally JJ goes in and teaches my framework, but I'm not allowed to teach the framework. And he's literally the world's leading academic on the framework. And so it's just a strange world. There's no question about it. And that's nothing against Vanderbilt. That's just the way the rules work, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And I love it, but no, I never went to college. And I did, you know, weirdly know when I was in high school that I wanted to be a New York Times bestselling author. And I don't know how I got that, because I wasn't making good grades, but I just had this inkling that I really wanted to express myself through the written word. And that happened about 10 years later.
Did you enjoy reading at all?
No, not really. Isn't that strange, Travis? I didn't. Yeah. I wasn't a ferocious reader. I became one when I was about 22 or 23, and I am today. But I didn't grow up reading books. I really have, now that I think of it, I have no idea how I sort of foresaw the idea I wanted to become a writer. Mm. And then wrote, and finally sat down in Common Grounds Coffee Shop in Portland, Oregon, where I lived, wrote one paragraph that I knew was the first paragraph of a book I would finish. Hmm. And somehow about a year later, that book was done and got my first book out of me, which wasn't very good. It sold like 23 copies. It sold nothing.
And 12 of them were family members. Yeah.
Travis, do you agree that, don't you think that part of success for a lot of people is delusional optimism? It's just like this.
Yeah. Especially when you don't come from much, you know, when you're just trying to figure it all out on your own.
Yeah, exactly. I will say I was delusionally optimistic from the time I was a kid, and I'm still delusionally optimistic. I mean, it's like anything can happen.
That's not a bad perspective to have on the world, though. You know, it's obviously worked out pretty well for you.
So much to be sad about, right?
Exactly.
We need more delusional optimists.
I agree. How do you know when you have a good book idea, right? Ideas are a dime a dozen. It's execution on ideas, and on an idea that's going to become something that's widely accepted or something that's going to pioneer an industry. Like, how do you know when you got something?
Well, the first test is yourself. You know, are you interested in this topic enough to more or less obsess about it for a year? Because that's about what it takes. I mean, some people can get a book done quicker, But, you know, are you going to be interested enough to finish this thing? That's sign number one. If you are, then there are probably thousands of people out there who would also be interested enough to read it. You know, so the first test, if it's interesting, is that you know whether or not you can stick with it. Ernest Hemingway said, the sign of a great writer, or something like that. I can't remember how he worded it. The sign of a great writer is they have a built-in shockproof shit detector. And really what he was saying, if you listen to him, is he's saying they know what's interesting. They, you know, they know. And I think I've got about a B plus on that. If you look at somebody like Steinbeck, they got an A plus, you know, that this is just interesting and they know how to make something interesting. You know, Annie Dillard is a literary figure. You know, she writes about fish swimming up a creek and ants climbing up a blade of grass, and I'm in. She makes it interesting.
Yeah,
she just makes it interesting. And so I think it's a lot of it is intuitive. And then once you pass that hurdle, it's pretty good to, I test material over, you know, I'm having lunch with somebody and I'll test it. I'll test something that I'm thinking about and see if even in casual conversation, they're interesting. Mm. I'll post a snippet from the book I'm working on Instagram just to see how many likes and comments I get. Mm. You know, you kind of test it out externally second. And then of course the publisher is a really great test because they're not going to bet on anything that they don't think has a shot at making the money.
Yeah, right.
And so there's the three prong test, the three levels of testing right there that if you're working on a book, that will help.
Is it intimidating at all? And I've kind of always wondered this. Is it intimidating at all to write a book on marketing? I mean, which is really, you know, your story brand is a marketing and branding book about storytelling, right? Is it intimidating to write? To me, it would seem to be intimidating to write a book on marketing because if it doesn't do well, then how proven are the concepts in your own book, right? You know what I mean? Like there's so many books on marketing. It's like, oh, like you said, it sold 23 copies. It's like, well, maybe if you took your own advice, it would sell more.
Thank God I actually thought of that after I published the book. And I'm so glad it never entered into my head before because I would have been scared as I could possibly be. Sure. I mean, you know, does it work? Yeah. And, but I think because we developed the framework and worked with it and taught it to so many businesses. I mean, there were probably over 1,000 businesses that we took through it.
Yeah.
And I saw what happened to those businesses. These businesses were doubling in sales by only changing the words on their website, only changing the words in their sales scripts and their elevator pitches and their, you know, the keynote of the CEO or whatever, just changing the way they talked about their product. What we were seeing significant increase in sales. And the great thing is words are free. So you're talking about a free way to double revenue. No, that's ridiculous. And so we were seeing that over and over and over and with nonprofits, for-profits, every, you know, industry agnostic. And so by the time I was writing the book, I knew I didn't have any doubt.
And yeah, it wasn't just theory.
It was making people a lot of money. And not only that, I had developed a little bit of frustration with the number of marketing agencies that were, in my opinion, they were ripping people off. They were charging them for marketing collateral that wasn't making them any money, their client any money. So I was a little frustrated about what was happening in the industry, and I wanted to give people a book for $20 that solved that problem. And I think that's one of the reasons the book actually took off. I think if I would have doubted that process, it probably would have, people would have felt it as they read the book.
Yeah.
But instead, I was just like, don't screw around with this. Like, these people will rip you off. Let's get this right. Let's sit down and do a little work here and clarify your message so your marketing collateral works. And so I think that probably came through in the book.
Sure. Yeah. So let's get kind of back into your story then really quickly. So you write your first book and it sells 23 copies. Where do you go from there?
23. I think it was like 21. I'm
yeah. You're exaggerating to make it sound better than it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I really was pretty arrogant. I thought I was the next John Steinbeck. It was a memoir about a cross-country trip in a Volkswagen van with a buddy. It was a true story. And I just thought I was the great writer. And I discovered I wasn't. So there was a season of kind of grief, you know, just like, I thought I was special and I was gifted. And thank God for that, because the next book was on the New York Times bestsellers list for 42 weeks. Mm. And I think I had a much more balanced perspective. I mean, I knew what it I knew what it was like. I felt more than I felt like my second book was this work of art. I felt really lucky. And I felt very, very grateful to the people who helped me. And it didn't take off for till the second year. And even one of my roommates was with an organization that told his bosses about it. And they ended up buying like 100,000 copies, which helped it sell. Wow. You know, so there were actual buddies involved in my success. And I think if my first book would have taken off, I would have become a little entitled, you know, punk. And instead, I became a slightly smaller entitled punk.
Yeah, it's like Mike Tyson says, right? Everybody thinks they're prepared until they get punched in the face.
They
or
get
something
punched
like
in the
that.
Face,
yeah,
man.
Right.
You know, and the only thing I give myself kudos for is after a failure, writing another one. Because it does, it takes a long time.
So
and
I was going to say
the only
thing
I go back and I say, good job, Miller. Like, good job getting back up and getting hit in the face again, you know?
Yeah, right. That's what I was going to say is like the coolest part about that story is that the phrase that you used just now when you're talking about it is the cool thing was that the next book. So you confirmed your feelings of doubt and insecurity and all these negative words that you would describe yourself as feeling during that time period, but there still came a next book. Why?
Yeah.
Why not quit after that?
I think it's probably like you and some things that you do and maybe even podcasting. I didn't feel like I had a choice.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what I was born to do. And I didn't have any more choice about whether to write the next book than I did about whether to eat food. I just needed it. I needed to sit down and these were memoirs. Cause what your audience may not know is I wrote 7 memoirs that have nothing to do with business before I wrote my first business book.
Wow.
So, you know, that was 7 years of studying story and studying literature and studying writing, which thank God, because I used all that in my business book.
Yeah.
And, so I just had to, write and, I certainly thought I was writing something that could be commercially viable, but it just wouldn't have mattered. I think if you'd have said, Don, you'll never publish this book, I would have said, that hurts. And a week later, I think I just stopped wiping my eyes and I sat down and I'm writing it anyway. And, I got no choice. So I'm going to be a very poor person holding a typewriter. That's what I guess. Yeah. That's all I can do.
can you speak into that for a second, Don? Because I guess my question is kind of, when do you know when you should continue to do something that you're not showing immediate results in? And when do you know that you're quitting too early? You know what I mean? Like when, at what point are you quitting too early? And at what point are you sticking in it for too long? And you should probably focus on something else that you're better at.
It's such a great question. It's so extremely hard to answer, right? Because delusional optimism will get you very, very far in life. And I really mean that. Delusional optimism, I was just talking to a young woman the other day, 13 years old. She came over to the house with her dad and her two brothers. They just wanted to come by and say hi. And she said she was a really slow reader. She's dyslexic. And I said, me too. I mean, I'm not dyslexic, but I am a slow reader. It takes me a long time to metabolize information and stuff. I said, the key though is don't quit. Don't quit. Keep like, I'll outpace anybody. I really will. I'm not fast and I'm not smart, but you will not outwork me. And if you don't quit, you have great success. So that's part of it. Then there's another part. There's probably like 3 or 4 books, at least 3, that I got good 40, 50,000 words into and then quit. And the reality was sometimes it was this actually, I'm now convinced that this isn't interesting commercially. You know, people aren't going to read it. Or this is just almost too controversial to share. It's going to make me look stupid for sharing this theory or something like that. Or it's not right for my career where I wanted to go. I was actually comforted a little bit by an interview I saw in 60 Minutes last night. I've been out of town off the grid. So I was catching up on my DVR. And 60 Minutes covered the career of Prince, who died 5 years ago. And they said he's got like dozens of albums that he never released. Yeah, he released 39 albums and he has dozens that he didn't release, including like 5 have come out, I think, since he died. So, the guy was prolific. And one of his backup singers and producers said, how do you feel about that? I mean, you're just not going to release it. You worked for a long time on that. And he said, I don't really look back. Let's do what's next. Mm. I don't really look back. None of that's precious to me. And so I think, that there's a lot there. There's a lot, if you're going to be a successful writer, at least, and probably in anything, you've got to just keep going out of the mass of production will become some things will be commercially viable, some things won't. But if you're writing just to publish, I don't think you're going to be you may get a good book or two, but you're not going to be a career writer. A career writer writes because they have to write. They just have to. And what gets published out of that gets published, and what doesn't doesn't. Hmm. But it doesn't matter. That's not why I wrote it. I wrote it because I just have to. And part of it is it's just every book is a big puzzle. And my wife loves doing jigsaw puzzles. I've never understood it. I'm like, if you're going to ask me to sit down and solve a problem, you're going to pay me a lot of money. So this jigsaw company, I don't see, you know, if I'm going to do a jigsaw puzzle, the company better send me a check.
Yeah, for where's my the time. Check? Yeah, put the check in the box, please. Yeah.
So, but my version of the jigsaw puzzle is the book. Mm. I love getting up in the morning, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m., almost 5 days a week, and sitting at the computer and trying to figure out what this book's about. Yeah, I enjoy the puzzle of it.
Can you give us a glimpse of what it truly takes to become a New York Times bestselling author? Because it obviously was a goal that you had in mind from when your time you were in high school, and it actually ended up happening for you now multiple times. You know, what can you tell us about that process?
You know, everybody listening, don't dismiss me based on the first thing I say, because there's more. But one of the ingredients is luck. It really is. One of the ingredients is luck, because, you know, I know people who've written great books that, and not only that, I have friends who are musicians. You know, I live here in Nashville who write beautiful records that everybody should know about, and they don't hit. And sometimes a really good book just won't hit. You know, go on Amazon, there's 5 million books. You know, one of them is the number one one. And so, you know, you can't tell me there's 4,999,000 bad books. You know, they just didn't hit number one. So luck is part of it. I think what goes into it is, you know, a lot of work writing a good book. I think most books that hit the New York Times have something of value to offer. You know, they may not be well written, but people are buying it for a reason. It's either really entertaining, it's a great story, they're solving a problem that, you know, if you write a book about stopping smoking, it doesn't have to be that great. You just help people stop smoking, and smokers are going to buy it. And hopefully there's enough of them that can put you on the New York Times bestsellers list. I mean that cryptically. You know? Yeah, so I hope there's not actually enough smokers to do that. But, you know, so you're solving a problem. And then I'll get into the real nitty gritty of it. My second book hit the New York Times for 40 something weeks. I've never had a book do that since. I've had plenty of books on the list for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks or whatever, but never something like that. I didn't even have an email list when that book hit. That book was pure word of mouth. Wow. And, you know, it did great. Then I started capturing email addresses later in my career, and I could email fans when I released a book. And that helped. I would say at least two of that. I don't know how many books I've had on the New York Times, but at least two of those would not have hit the Times had I not had an email list. In other words, you know, word of mouth just wouldn't have done it.
Because the concept wasn't big enough, because the total addressable market wasn't big enough. Like, why do you say that?
Because it's really hard to hit the list. You know, the market was big enough, the concept was good enough, but you've got to get between 7 and 10,000 people to buy that book in the first week. And that means probably 50,000 email addresses, you know, because not everybody's going to buy it. So, but the good thing is, you know, if you really want to be a commercially successful writer, start collecting email addresses now. Because I can go to any publisher in the world and say, I've got 450,000 email addresses and I've got a book sitting here, and they're going to sign me.
Sure.
You know, unless there's something immoral about it, which I don't write that stuff, they're going to sign me. So, you know, they're trying to make money. And, you know, it's a part of the game as being a writer is getting that audience and developing your tribe and being commercially viable. Now, if you want to write a book and you don't really care how many sell, because there's all sorts of other great reasons to write a book, you know, ignore my advice. But if you think about it, it's luck, it's skill, it's hard work, and it's self-promotion. So luck, skill, hard work, self-promotion. Now you get to control 3/4 of that.
Yeah, right.
Well, I don't know if you can, you know, skill is something you can learn. Hard work is something anybody can do. And promotion is something, if you're humble, you can do it. If you're arrogant, you won't self-promote because you want to be so special everybody comes to you. And I wrote that book. It's my first book. It didn't sell any copies. Wow.
What an interesting way to phrase that. Oh, no. That.
People who are arrogant don't self-promote. People who are humble, you know, it's embarrassing to go out and talk about yourself. You know, you got to be humble to do it. You got to get over yourself and believe that your message is important enough for people to read. And then you'll go out and promote. If you're not promoting your book, you don't think it's medicine for anybody's pain.
Yeah.
And if it's medicine for somebody's pain, I think you have a moral obligation to go out and talk about it.
Yeah. If you truly think that you created something that can solve a problem. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. You're helping people.
Why wouldn't you?
It's not about you. It's about, it's about your problem being solved. And you get a little bit of money for that. You get your name on a book and you deserve that. That's great because you're out there really providing value for people.
So this is the Build Your Network podcast. We talk a lot about relationships, about networking.
Yeah. We forgot to mention the network part.
Yeah. So along those lines, I want to ask you a couple questions on that. The first one that I always ask, though, every guest ever come on the show, we're coming up on 600 episodes now, so it's quite a few.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're super happy with it. So we've gotten a number of different types of answers for this question, and this is probably the book that I want to write. So I'm curious to hear what your perspective is. Who you know or what you know, Don, which of those two is the more valuable asset in life and why?
Oh, man. Well, I'm going to go with who you know, but we're at a 51% versus 49% ratio there.
Sure.
Because you can't be dumb. You have to be, you really do have to be competent.
Yeah.
But if you reverse engineer your life, you can see that a lot of the doors were opened by somebody. And not just doors open, but somebody knew how to put together technology that you needed. And I credit, I got married 8 years ago and I got married at 42. I got married late. Well, 7.5 years ago, I'm 49. And my career absolutely exploded after I got married. And it's because I have such a stable home. I mean, I didn't have an unstable life. I've had a great single life. But, there's no drama in my house. Betsy's an amazing person. It's who I know. It's who I know and who feeds my soul and who opens doors. It's a lot of who you know. But that's not just luck. That's also you, because you're the kind of person that a quality person wants to get to know.
Right.
So you're in control of a lot of that too. You're the person who I always look at relationships that if you invest time in me or invest something in me, I want to give you a bigger return than you invested. So if you're going to invest some friendship in me, I want to be a better friend. Maybe I'm just a competitive guy, but I want to be a better friend to you than you are to me. And that, I want to be a better husband to Betsy than she is a wife to me, which I have never once single in a day accomplished that, but I still want to do it. And
it's a worthy pursuit. Yeah.
It's a worthy pursuit. Yeah. I think all men are in that boat. Like you can't even 100%. Compete. Give me a break. And, so that to me is, you're in those relationships. However, when you get your opportunity to take the shot, you got to make the shot.
Right.
Who may get you on the team, but it's not going to score points. Yeah, you have to be competent. So I think I'd put it really close to 50-50. And that's one of the reasons, Travis, in the world that we live in now, I started a Black-owned business cohort because people are tribalistic. They tend to choose people who look like them and think like them and act like them. And so, the Black Lives Matter movement really showed me, gosh, even though I grew up dirt poor, really worked my butt off to get to where I'm at. I believe that white privilege is a thing. And I believe that doors open for me because I knew people who were in, who had a company. My first job, guy gave me a job working at Jackhammer in August in Houston. It was tough as nails, but yeah, really hard. And, then the guy gave me a job in publishing. The guy gave me a job and there are just more white people than there are minorities. Therefore, there are more people looking out for people who look like me than there are. That's not necessarily racism. It's definitely subconscious bias. But, I started a Black-owned business cohort because I wanted to contribute to getting more people more opportunities and giving and introducing people who have not had doors open for them unfairly and unjustly. And so those of us who've succeeded a little bit can look around and say, hey, how can I even the playing field here? How can I be one of the people that they know that is going to get them a leg up?
Yeah, that's going to put them on, like
that's right. Yeah.
So just, many people, so many
stories.
Give
everybody a chance to take a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sadly, everybody in my Black-owned business cohort is more successful than me. So I learned more from them. I learned more from them than they learned from me. That's for sure. But
that tells me that you're doing the networking thing right, though, right?
There you go. Yeah. I want to be the smartest one in the world. Like. That's oh, never, exactly ever. Right. I love that. You're the only guy. I say that all the time. You're the only guy I've ever heard say it first. And it's just, it is a fundamental principle. If you're the smartest guy in the room, you ain't learning anything.
You're in the wrong room. Go find a different
room. Wrong room. Yeah. We call it, at my company, we have a value. We call it swimming out past the breakers. So what that means is you're out past the place in the ocean where you feel comfortable. You're not you're not out there going nuts, but you're just right at that place where your toes only touch every fourth or fifth wave going
yeah,
down. You're
like, it's coming in. Yeah.
Yeah. We want you slightly uncomfortable. So we want to put you in a position doing things that if you're slightly uncomfortable, you're growing. And I think that's true in relationships too. If you're slightly uncomfortable because this person is so successful and so far ahead of you, you're growing. You're growing.
Yeah, that's so true. I've so many times been in situations like that where I'm like, should I even be here right now?
Exactly. Yeah.
I'll just slip out the back. Like nobody's going to, you know, notice, yeah. You know? But yeah, to your point, I mean, if there's no discomfort, there's no growth. And, you know, you got to ask yourself what version of life you want to live, one where there's growth or one where there's stagnation. And if the answer is growth, then you got to get familiar with being uncomfortable.
Here's a good story. I just got back. Travis, you should know about this. I'm not even going to plug my company. I'm going to plug this guy's company. Okay. I went on a wilderness adventure with a group called Wilderness Collective. And my buddy Steve actually runs the company. It was me and five friends plus four of their staff members. We did 350 miles or so all around the Grand Canyon on motorcycles and UTVs and no showers for 4 days. We ate great food because they actually have a guy in a sag wagon who's a chef.
That's awesome.
But I mean, we were filthy, sleeping on the ground, you know, you're freezing at night. I mean, it was rough, but I'm in a UTV going 60, 70 miles per hour through the desert. I mean, treacherous terrain, like creek bed kind of stuff. And all the motorcycles are way back behind us because they've got to go much slower. But Steve, who runs the company, is flying on a motorcycle ahead of me. And I can't keep up with him. I have no idea how he didn't die. I mean, we're talking, you know, guys are falling. My buddy fell off his motorcycle 15 times. My other buddy flipped his UTV. I mean, it was just nuts.
Wow.
And that night I'm sitting by the fire. I'm like, Steve, how long, you know, I said, when's your last big crash? He goes, I haven't crashed since I was a kid. So what are you talking about? What are you talking about? There's no possible way you haven't crashed since you were a kid. You're flying on that motorcycle. We're talking doing 90 miles per hour and through treacherous terrain. And he said, no, he said, I really haven't. And I said, how'd you get so good? He said, you know what I do? He said, I push the envelope for a little while, maybe 5 minutes. And then I back off to about 60% for the rest of the hour. Then I push the envelope for 5 minutes. Then I back off to about 60% for the rest of the hour. He said, if you stay in that mode where you're pushing it, you're going to get in trouble. But you got to push it every once in a while in order to get to make the 60% increase. So his 60% is everybody else's 100% because he's continued to push it. And I thought that is such great life advice in anything in our career, push it and then back off, push it and then back off, push. But you got to have these seasons where you jump into the deep end. And that may be joining a mastermind or a community or a group that where you just feel like you're out of place, but you can't live there. You're going to get an ulcer.
That is very well said. Yeah. I've been there, done that.
Yeah. Go do something uncomfortable.
Oh man. Really well said. That's funny. I got to ask you just to break down for us because I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't. Break down for us the framework of building a story brand and why it's so important.
Well, it's an ancient narrative framework that really probably the first guy who wrote down something like it wasn't the same was Plato in his book Poetics. And then 100 other books have been written on the subject of narrative structure. What had never been done was taking the elements of story that people use to write screenplays and people use to write plays and people use to write books and turning it into a message clarification framework. And so what do I mean by that? I mean that most people, when they talk about their company, they do a terrible job describing what they do. And most of the time when they're finished, nobody wants to buy it. And so what building a story brand, my book does, is it takes all that I learned about writing those books and keeping people interested in turning the pages and uses those principles to help people be interested in what you're doing and what you're selling. And so, you know, there's seven elements to the structure. I'll give you three. These three you can take with you and use, and everybody listening can really experience a lot of success if you just understand these three. That is problem, product, result. So let's say that I'm at a party and there's a couple of people there who do the same thing. They're at-home chefs. They cook in your home. And they both charge the exact same amount. And they're just as good as each other. Not one of them is better than the other one. You know, they're about the same. Well, you go up to one, you say, what do you do? And they say, well, I'm an at-home chef. You're probably going to say, oh, where'd you go to culinary school? And, you know, you ever cooked for anybody famous? And, you know, what are your favorite restaurants? My wife and I love to go out to eat. You're going to have a casual conversation with that person. You go to the next chef and they say, you say, what do you do? And they say, well, you know, most families don't eat together anymore. And when they do, they don't eat healthy. Well, I'm an at-home chef. I come to your house and I cook so your family can spend really quality time connecting with each other. And when you're done eating, you don't feel guilty about what you ate. You're going to say, how do I do business with you?
Sign me up. Yeah.
Sign me up. Well, the first person told you what they did. The second person told you the problem they solve, the product they use to solve it, and the result that you will experience if you buy the product. What they did was they invited you into a short story. They invited you into a story in which you solve a problem with their products so that you can experience a climactic scene. Your problem is your family's not eating together anymore. The product that I want you to buy is my services as an at-home chef. And when you do, you'll experience the climactic scene of sitting around a table with your family, having a great conversation and eating healthy food. What everybody would do business with the second chef, because the second chef invited them into a story and the first chef told them what they did. Mm. That's what building a story brand is really about in a nutshell. It's about learning to communicate in such a way. You know, I would give speeches and get, you know, 5% of the audience would give me their email addresses when I did my call to action. After I wrote Building a Story Brand and understood how this stuff worked, 99%, often when I speak, 99% of that audience will pull out their phone and give me their email address. Wow. I'm giving away the same material. It's just the second way I did it was inviting people into a story.
What other areas of our life improve when you learn how to tell a good story?
Well, when you understand story, your entire life improves. The book that I just turned in last Thursday will come out in January, a long way away. It's called Hero on a Mission. The opening chapter of that book is called The Victim, The Villain, The Hero, and The Guide. The four roles we play in life and the one that matters most. And what that chapter basically says is there is a victim inside you. There is a villain inside you. There is a hero inside you, and there is a guide inside you. And you will play all four every day, whether you like it or not. However, the more you play the victim, the worse your life is going to go. The more you play the villain, the worse your life is going to go. The more you play the hero, the better your life is going to go. And the more you play the guide, the better your life is going to go. There's two characters inside you that you do not want to bring out very often. And there are two characters that you want to live in. There are a lot of people who get stuck playing the victim character, and it ruins their lives. There are a lot of people who get stuck playing the villain character and they are either killed or put in prison. People who play the heroic character face challenges, experience transformation, and are richly rewarded at the end of their journey. And people who play the guide character turn around and help heroes win the day, and they ultimately experience a deep sense of meaning in life. Really, we start as victims because we're babies and we can't help ourselves. We're all victims when we're babies. We have that long heroic journey that transforms into a guide journey as we get older and can help people win. That's the natural path of life. But if you stay victim, or if you get sidetracked and become a villain, things get really bad. And it's not just true in your life. It's true in a given day, right? In a given day, you know, villains seek vengeance. And when we find ourselves wanting to hurt somebody because they hurt us, you're in trouble. It's not going to end well for you. Heroes seek justice. So somebody wrongs us, they don't seek vengeance, they seek justice. And it's very different. And things go well usually for the hero. So, you know, the more you understand story, the more you can use it to direct and guide your life toward better outcomes.
Well, hey, listen, I don't think I could have ended this on a better note. Let's go ahead and move into the final round. Some like to call the random round, just quick random questions, quick random answers. You ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
What profession other than your own do you think that it would be fun to attempt?
You know, it's pretty close to what I already do, but one would be a professor. I'd love to just have students for a long period of time, for a year, and really help transform them. That's too close to what I do to be an interesting answer. So I'm going to say chef. I would love to be able to cook better and better and better.
If you could sit on a park bench with someone, past or present, and chat for an hour, who would it be?
Emily Dickinson. She's an American poet out of Amherst, Massachusetts. And I found her, I studied her when I was young, and I find her to be fascinating. She's the one, I memorized a bunch of her poems when I was young, and she taught me an economy of words. So I think because I was young and I was memorizing her poetry, she became a fascinating figure to me. I'd sit with Emily Dickinson.
How do you like to consume content? Books, audiobooks, blogs, podcasts, videos?
All the above. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I do read every Saturday morning. I get a couple hours to do that. I read about an hour and a half a day, but Saturday morning I focus on books. So books, a lot of podcasts, and that's probably it. Betsy and I fall asleep watching some Netflix series almost every night, usually a dumb comedy.
Nice. What are you watching right now?
We're going through Arrested Development for like the third time.
Great show. That's so funny. That's basically our type of media consumption as well. It's usually just a sitcom that's on in the background. We're just on a Modern Family kick, and now we're back onto Brooklyn Nine-Nine for a little bit. So,
okay, two good ones. Modern Family, might have to add that to our punch list.
It's a good one if you're a fan of.
I've seen it.
Oh, okay, you have. Okay,
yeah, we would do it again.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth it. This is probably our second or third time that we were going through it. And then, a book and a podcast that you'd recommend to an entrepreneurial audience.
There are so many good ones. You know, anything by Andrew Grove. Only the Paranoid Succeed. Andrew Grove was was CEO at Intel. He's a really great leader. He thinks like an engineer, but I really like his books. Podcasts other than yours, you know, How I Built This is always inspirational. You know, it's always inspirational. Talking to entrepreneurs about how they built this multi-billion-dollar company or something like that, you know, it's always inspirational to know that they've struggled with the same things you're struggling with. So How I Built This is the name of a really good podcast.
Give us a glimpse of your morning routine.
7 a.m., usually hopefully up before then, but I drink a cup of decaf coffee. I take a whole bowl of vitamins, I feel like. I do not eat breakfast because I can't write after I eat. And so I skip breakfast. I usually go to a coffee shop or I come here. This is called the bunker. It's a room in the back of the garage that I'm talking to you from. And I work from 7 a.m., hopefully till 9 a.m., when I have a staff meeting. And then if I don't have a staff meeting, I work till 10 a.m., which is usually the next meeting. So I get 2 or 3 hours almost every day to write. And that's my morning ritual.
What is your go-to pump-up song?
I don't have one. Maybe I need one. Let's see. When I really need to be pumped up, it's probably something from, I'm going to probably date myself, probably something from Foo Fighters. If I really want to get my blood going. Get some rock and roll going.
What, setting business aside, just general life here, what's something that you are just not very good at?
Everything.
Everything but writing, right?
Yeah, I can write and I'm good at that. I'm pretty bad at everything else. Something I'm not very good at. That's the question, right?
Yes. Yep. So for instance, I am horrible with laundry.
Yeah. I am terrible at small talk at a party. I think I'm good one-on-one, but as soon as there are five or more people in the room, I can't do it. I don't know why. If somebody can reverse psychoanalyze me, but I'm not sure.
As we get everything wrapped up here, Don, what's one place online where you want our listeners to go connect with you the most?
Oh, you know, I do something really fun every Wednesday called Website Wednesday. And I take somebody's website and I review it and explain why I think they need to use a different tagline or a different header or a different call to action, why they need a value stack, why, you know, I basically deconstruct their website.
Nice.
And then Emily on my staff, just because we have fun doing this, creates a new website for them, literally creates a PDF, not an actual website, but a visual PDF of what we think their website should look like. And we've seen companies do this in double revenue. And I do that every Wednesday. We just started about a month ago, but you can go to businessmadesimple.com/website, enter your domain name, and I choose 52 winners every year.
Nice. businessmadesimple.com/website. If you want to get your website analyzed by one of the best in the game, definitely go check that out. And if you haven't read his book, Building a Story Brand, you have to go order that book right now and add it to your queue. I promise you will not regret it. Don, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show today. I had a blast chatting with you.
Travis, thanks for having me.
That's it for this episode. If you want to connect with Travis and other like-minded people who also listen to the show, then you're going to want to head over to travischappell.com/group to join his free Facebook group, Podcast to Profit. Travis will see you there. And remember to leave every relationship better than you found it.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.